Welcome to the Trade Securely Podcast.
I'm Janet Eastman. Now, our goal with this Trade Securely Podcast is to help businesses understand how they can operate and trade securely at home and abroad. And this week, my guest is REAC member Corey Breed, who's an account executive with Magnus Group, a full-service insurance brokerage. Corey is a trade credit insurance specialist. So welcome to the show, Corey. Nice to meet you by podcast.
Yeah, nice to meet you, as they say, as well. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. So it's my understanding you've been in this business for approximately 7 years or so. What was your first introduction to receivables insurance? Do you remember?
Absolutely. It was through a mutual friend at the time who had a family member working in the space already. And Coface, one of the largest insurers here in Canada and abroad as well, had an opening for an account executive. Worked there at Coface for just under 5 years as an agent working exclusively with trade credit insurance, and then more recently joining the Magnus Group as a broker specialist for the last 2 years or so now.
Okay, so when you first were introduced to trade credit or receivables insurance, were you even aware of it?
No, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Not that I was aware of a lot of different product offerings in the commercial insurance space, but it really did catch my interest as something unique and that could actually help business owners run and grow their businesses as we head into the future. And it was something that I wanted to become a specialist and focus my efforts on.
Yeah. So based on that, in your experiences, why are businesses initially interested in receivables insurance? And does it come to them as a complete surprise that there is this type of insurance?
Great question. In my experience, I'd say more often than not, it is a new product or kind of an awareness exercise for them. And I say this because at the time when I was an agent with Coface, about half of the business I placed was directly with end users, i.e. business owners, and the other half would have been through brokers. Now that I'm on the broker side of the equation, I understand that on those 50% of deals I was working on, you know, there was a broker in the background, but for whatever reason, the client chose to work with an agent. So I can only imagine it's something that the broker hadn't even put in front of the client. As to what prompts action on their behalf, there's a number of different factors, but I think there's usually kind of an external force, if you will, or event that prompts some action. So most commonly what I see is it's, you know, simply a requirement by somebody's bank. And if that's the case, it's usually a simple exercise and the client just goes along with what their bank recommends. But secondly, it could be something like, you know, just an internal desire to be better, to improve due diligence efforts and try and provide some peace of mind with respect to protecting their bottom line. So, you know, there's some concentration of risk in their receivables, or maybe they've been burned in the past. You know, unfortunately, that can prompt action to look into ways to transfer that risk to an insurance policy. Very often in early stage conversations with clients, you know, I threw out something like, I bet if we were to look at your balance sheet right now, your receivables balance is likely one of, if not the largest uninsured asset. And I think that statement in and of itself just validates the fact that we're having a discussion around it, and whether or not it makes sense at the end of the day is secondary to just having that conversation.
Yeah. So is that basically what some of the common business objectives are for clients? They just kind of understand once you've talked to them about what receivables insurance can do, they understand that. And then they go, okay, well, you know, if it's going to help me do more business with my bank or do more business and get the support of my bank, et cetera, this is why I want to get on board.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I threw the bank example out there because I think it's a leading reason why businesses investigate or look into trade credit insurance, but the sales growth angle is definitely an undervalued one. So just to give you some, you know, real life examples, right now I'm in ongoing conversations with a business out of the Kitchener-Waterloo area who sells to GCs, and they've got general contractors, that is. And
okay.
They've got some new project opportunities in the U.S. that they've, you know, never had before, and they're quite large in scale based on the size of their operation. So they're viewing this not as something to satisfy their bank. They're quite well funded and self-funded at that. It's more a, you know, we don't necessarily know these guys, but if we can qualify the risk through a credit insurance program, it could make a lot of sense. another client I'm working with in the distribution space has a situation where not even their largest, but a mid-sized distributor they work with is looking at cutting out another vendor and effectively doubling the amount of business they do with my client. So as you can imagine, it's something they want to jump all over, but they want to make sure they're crossing their T's and dotting their I's first and making sure it's a good risk for them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, so from the client's perspective, what is the difference between working with an agent or working with a broker?
Another great question. I think I'm in a unique situation and I worked as both an agent and a broker. It's a very small pool, I would say, of broker specialists that are out there and even fewer that have worked as an agent before. So based on my interactions, I'm not sure that the client truly understands the difference between an agent and a broker. So if I could put it simply, I'd say working with an agent would mean that you're working with someone from the insurance company itself, whereas working with a broker means you're working with an independent third party, someone who does not work for the insurance company, but in effect works for you, the business owner, as a trusted advisor.
Right. Okay. And then in the event of a claim or whatnot, that broker does a lot of the heavy lifting for the business owner, right? When it's trying to sort that claim out.
Absolutely. So they can get involved and act as a third party advocate for them as well. I know with the Magnus Group, we've got an in-house claims staff. Some other specialist brokerages may or may not as well. So that means in the event that there is a claim, it can take the legwork off the client and actually have someone dedicated to follow up on that. Because as you know, very often the squeaky wheel gets the grease, so to speak. So it can expedite the claims process and ensure things are followed up with quickly.
Yeah. Are you finding that the businesses that you're dealing with in Canada, are they seeking out trade credit insurance for domestic or export primarily?
I'd say it depends on the situation. So if it's a bank-driven exercise where the bank's requiring them to insure their receivables to unlock additional financing to run the operation, I think the business is interested in insuring everything that they can to maximize their borrowing base. Oftentimes the calls I get inbound are something like, hey, I've got potential for, one customer, say overseas, is that something I can insure? So from a sales growth perspective, I see a lot of concerns around export receivable insurance versus domestic. And I think that's simply because, they feel that they have less power or powerless if things go sideways, if somebody's, let's say, in Europe versus just here around the bend in Ontario, for example.
Yeah, distance makes it a little bit more scary.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay, so are most of your clients then large or small businesses? I mean, what is the average size of a company that is actually seeking out trade credit insurance?
Sure. I think it might vary between carrier to carrier. So for example, I know some of the non-cancelable carriers generally look to, underwrite larger credit exposures and rely on the internal due diligence of the company, whereas some other cancelable carriers may look at themselves as more of an outsourcing of a credit department. So I think some of those guys, you'd see, average premiums in the, $15,000 to $20,000 range, something indicative of a, company with $5 to $10 million in annual revenue. As for the clients I work with, I guess it would depend on what you define as large or small. Historically, I think the smallest company I would have worked with, something in the neighborhood of, $1.5 million in annual revenue, and on the larger end, closer to $100 million in revenue. Mm-hmm. But if there's a sweet spot, I'd say it's probably something around the $10 million mark.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I'm sure that if you've gone out there and you've tried to approach a business about receivables insurance, trade credit insurance, what are some of those objections that they may put forward for saying, oh, we just don't need this insurance? And like I have heard in the past where people have said that they have heard from the client, we have worked with these guys for 25 years. They always pay on time. It's never been an issue. And then suddenly the bottom falls out of the business and they're caught completely by surprise. So how do you counter some of those common objections that people might give you for saying, no, I don't need this insurance?
Sure. Oh my God. If I had a dollar for every time that's happened, and I'm sure anybody who's focused their efforts exclusively on trade credit would echo those sentiments. I mean, I guess you try, right? But it depends on the objection. So again, real life example, I've reached out to one of my clients, customers recently, just to, you know, say, hey, we know someone in common, like to introduce myself. Here's what we're working together on. I think it might be of value for you. Very often it's quick, you know, to get brushed off with, just as you said, you know, we don't have any problems with our AR. We don't need it. We're not interested. It almost sounds like a knee-jerk reaction. So it's difficult to try and get around that sort of mindset when you're, you know, simply trying to introduce AR insurance, let alone discuss it. So, I mean, personally, I try not to view those as objections per se, but just understand where they're coming from. And the demand on everybody's time these days is, you know, higher than it's ever been, whether I'm reaching out to a business owner or, you know, the receptionist or gatekeeper, if you will. So trying to put myself in their shoes, you know, I can understand where they're coming from. So the challenge is there just to, you know, lower their guard, if you will, enough just to have an honest conversation. Because if I'm in the people I'm meeting with shoes, you know, it could be a controller, you know, VP, director of finance, or president, depending on the size of the company. At the very least, it's something I'd want to know about to make a conscious decision if I decide to self-insure against bad debt losses versus just one born out of ignorance and not simply knowing it was an option.
Mm-hmm. Could you share any stories that would indicate or that show just how receivables insurance or trade credit insurance has actually save someone's bacon? Like we've talked about in the past on these podcasts, you know, the Sears bankruptcy and things like that. And sometimes you see these things coming and you believe that they're coming, and other times things happen suddenly and all of a sudden, you know, somebody's just not going to be able to pay their bill. Like, do you have some of those horror stories that maybe came out with a happy ending or maybe didn't that you can share with us?
Definitely. I mean, you mentioned Sears there, and I think the retail sector has been one that all insurers would admit they're gun-shy on for the moment. I know last year and even now as it's coming up for renewal, I'm having a very difficult time finding insurers who are looking to take on new Hudson's Bay exposure. But the first one that comes to mind is a company I worked with in my early days at Coface. They were a small furniture manufacturer in Toronto, did about $4 million in annual revenue. And just like you said, it was a situation where their, you know, largest customer, a distributor, was one they not only had worked with for like 25 years, it's one that they had a personal relationship with outside of work. And it's like, you know, we don't see a need to insure them. They pay us like clockwork. But after not knowing about trade credit insurance and learning about it, they decided, you know, it was a prudent thing to do and insure it. As you can imagine, you know, weeks, months go by, I get a call from the client saying, hey, look, you know, my customer, he's 2 weeks past due. You know, I'm getting worried. How do I submit a claim to make sure I get paid? And my response was, you know, they're only 2 weeks. Like, if any of the other clients I work with got paid 2 weeks beyond invoice terms, they'd be ecstatic. Like, don't worry. You've got some time to submit a claim. And they said, no, like, this is not like them. And I said, okay, well, you know, I told them the timelines involved, and they decided to wait it out a bit longer. Inevitably, though, you know, a couple more weeks went by. They said, look, our phone calls, emails, not getting a response. You know, we drove by the office. There's no cars in the parking lot. The lights are off. Like, what's going on? You know, and I don't necessarily know this customer from a hole in the ground. So we submit a claim. And then weeks after that, you know, I'm working through a bankruptcy filing for like an unrelated entity. And then sure enough, I see a name as an unsecured creditor that I recognize. And it was my client's distributor. So it was a situation where it wasn't necessarily something that my client's customer did wrong, but it was my client's customer's customer. So I think the moral of the story here is not necessarily how well you know your customer, but, you know, how far down that chain, you know, are you, do you have line of sight to? Because a domino effect very often could, you know, occur, and then my client or your business could get caught in the mix.
Yeah, and it is that domino effect, right? You can't see that far out, and you can't be tracking everybody. So yeah, it's best to just make sure your assets are covered, I guess. so once a business actually gets a receivables insurance policy and they've gone through, let's say it's coming due again, do they, generally speaking, usually renew? Like they've done it once and they go, yeah, I get the value of this policy, and they just stay on? I've had conversations with people where they say, yeah, once people buy this stuff, they don't give it up.
Yeah, I mean, that's been my experience. I'm not going to say there's a 100% renewal rate, because there's not. I'd suggest my history has worked out something around the 90% range.
Okay.
And what it is, it's, I mean, it's an annual policy. So, I mean, the process that we've implemented here at Magnus is to, you know, sit down with the client, you know, 90 days before it renews, just understand where they were at the start of the year, you know, what's gone well, what hasn't gone so well, what tweaks would they like to make. So really, as we do the cost-benefit analysis of having versus not having a program, I think often the conversation leads to renewing it. The main reason I've seen clients not insure their policy would be kind of like the story I described. If a client had a key customer and was one of the main reasons for buying insurance, and that customer goes bankrupt, and it's happened more than once, you know, in that example, this was a $4 million company that paid, I think, $12,000 or $13,000 in premium and got paid in excess of $200,000 with respect to a shock loss that, you know, the insurers viewed as a good risk, but, you know, also weren't line of sight to what could be coming down the pipe for that distributor. Once that risk is gone, then, you know, as you can imagine, you know, premiums increase somewhat, deductibles increase somewhat, but the reason for insuring for that client wasn't there anymore. Similarly, if, you know, a client loses contracts with key customers, and again, that was their sole reason for insuring, that's another reason why I see them choose to self-insure. It's not very often at all that, you know, nothing's changed in the business and they just decide to, you know, sock away that premium for a rainy day sort of thing, as opposed to putting a trade credit policy in place.
I guess in the end, everybody's situation is different. And so they just have to investigate. And the job of the insurance provider or the broker is to get the best possible fit for their client.
Exactly. And that's just it. And that's what I'm trying to do at the end of the day, is leave them with more knowledge than they started the day with, so that at the very least they're aware of, you know, risk transfer options out there. If it does make sense from a cost benefit perspective, great. And if it doesn't, you know, maybe you can get some insight as to what insurers think of your key customers. It's always interesting in that if we get to that stage and there's some interest in a policy and we market it to the insurers that are out there and come back with credit opinions on, let's say, a business's top 10 customers, you'll inevitably have a situation where they're saying, oh, like, you'll insure customer so-and-so? Wow, I thought for sure you wouldn't insure them. Or you won't insure this customer, but they pay me, again, like clockwork. Like, I don't understand what's going on. And it's a matter of, you know, you may be getting paid on time from a customer, but that customer's other suppliers may not be getting paid on time. And if that's the situation, isn't that information you'd like to tap into?
Mm-hmm. Corey, it's a very interesting business. And I know that when people sit down to understand these policies and figure out what's going to work best for them, it's a bit time consuming and whatnot, but you guys are there to walk them through the process and take some of the murkiness out of it. So thanks very much for taking time to have a conversation with me about this.
No, thanks for having me on. I hope it's been insightful. And yeah, as we continue to go through 2019, I'm sure there'll be some additional new changes in the marketplace. I'm just already reading the headlines on what kind of is going on in the U.S. and China's posing ongoing concerns for a lot of businesses who export. And it's a very difficult time for those who are looking to expand their sales internationally, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, that is definitely an area we're going to want to look at. So, Corey, thank you so much for chatting with me and joining us on the Trade Securely podcast. Corey Breed is an account executive at the Magnus Group, and we are here to help businesses understand how they can operate and trade securely at home and abroad. Thanks very much for listening.